It's time for Type 40, or Doctor Who podcast, on the Fandom Podcast Network. On this show, we take an in-depth and closer look at this beloved television series. The spin-offs, the merchandise, and the fandom itself. Doctor Who shaped the landscape of science fiction and fantasy for well over five decades, with a brand new season. It's 38th in total, premiering now on BBC One, BBC America, and other broadcasters the whole world over. So step into our TARDIS, share our journey together through Series 12 with a couple of little diversions along the way. You know what this thing's like. Here on Type 40, we've been expecting you, Commander. A belated Happy New Year. 2020's up and running after a short break. So are we, and this is the first of our reviews of the latest series of Doctor Who. We're roping in lots of fresh voices this year, as well as some that long-term listeners will recognise. They're waiting patiently here now with a warm drink and warm hearts. I'm Dan Hadley. I'm the regular Type 40 pilot, Birmingham's King of the Geeks, and a lifelong Doctor Who fan. Not that that's particularly crucial to talk about or enjoy the programme. Series 12, for example, could be your first, or Jodie Whittaker could be your first Doctor, and that's fine with us. You're fine here with us. There's seriously no gatekeeping here, only conversation, some lively reviews, some fun and games along the way. And seeing as conversations take more than one, of course, it's not just me you're going to have to listen to, you'd be pleased to know. This opening show of the year, we've roped in two of Her Majesty's Secret Service's very finest. Hang on, hold on a second. Moneypenny, will you send in Agent Starry-Eyed Girl, please? It's our Sarah. Welcome back, Sarah.
Hello, Dan. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Well, I say fine. You know, we say fine, don't we? Fine in some ways. I've been finer, but I've been a lot less fine. Yes, Christmas and New Year. That was quick, wasn't it? What happened there?
I don't know. I blinked and missed it.
Yeah, well, there'll be another one around soon enough. And to be, because we're in the TARDIS, of course, you know, we could always do it again in a couple of days if you fancy, can't we? Hit a button and, yeah, we go pick whatever Christmas you like. A vintage Christmas or one to come, who knows? What did you do? How was it? Did you spend a lot of time with family and things like
that? Yeah, it was quite a quiet Christmas. My brother and sister-in-law went with us there honeymooning in Thailand for the next 4 weeks.
Oh, wow.
So we've been video calling. It's been a bit difficult because obviously it's about 7 hours between us, but we managed to talk to them on Christmas Day and at New Year. So that's been
the
nice.
The nerve of some people.
Some lovely videos of them being boiling hot in shorts, and I'm there in my Christmas jumper, my woolly socks.
So they didn't rub it in at all then?
No, not at all.
No. So you're still talking to them, obviously.
I'm still talking to them. Yeah, I got a couple of nice Doctor Who gifts as well. I got Christopher Eccleston's autobiography.
Oh, yes. So, what's that called again? Remind us of the title.
I can't remember.
I love the bones of you.
Oh is yeah, it's to do. It's yeah. Yeah, it's an ode to his dad. Yeah,
fantastic.
I'll find it and I'll send you the
bit of a light bedtime reading there. Yeah. Well, hang about a little because hang on, my other light's flashing right now, and that could be Q Branch. I'll just see what they've got to say. Yeah, send in Agent 0083, please. Known to you and I as Horton, Simon Horton. Hello, mate. Take a seat.
Hello, Dan. Thank you very much. Happy New Year to you too.
I'm going to live this Bond thing. This is my one opportunity to just go with it.
Well, Doctor Who's done that for the last 2 weeks. You've got to run with it, haven't you? Why not?
Certainly. How were you? How was Christmas and
Christmas
New Year for you?
Christmas was good. Christmas, apart from the fact that I had the typical stinking cold right up until Christmas, fortunately gone by Christmas. So yeah, had a good Christmas. Watched K9 and Company, as I always do. Thoroughly enjoyed that. Went to the cinema as well to see the latest Star Wars film, because that's become a bit of a Christmas tradition for me as well. So went and saw that, and had a pretty rum old time. I love Christmas, so I'm really, really upset to see it gone. Roll on the next one, as far as I'm concerned.
The whole thing with K9 and Company, do you watch it on a set day or a set time, or just fit it in where you can?
No, I do tend to fit it in where I can, but if I can, I tend to try. I'm this sad. I do tend tend to try and put it in on the 28th of December because that's when it first went out in 1981. Oh. So I it's one of those things, to be honest. I know we talked about this on the last Christmas podcast, that for me, well, for many Doctor Who fans, that was a really quite a significant thing. It was the first time ever that we'd had anything Doctor Who outside the main program. So it was a really quite a big significant thing. It was the first time we'd ever have a proper Christmas special. Yeah. So it was a major thing. And for me, as a, what was I, 12 years old at the time, that was just really, really exciting. And because I do love Christmas as well, it was just kind of perfect. I love Doctor Who, love Sarah Jane Smith, love K-9, love Christmas. What's not to like?
Exactly. And if it hits those sweet spots, if that fast tracks you to a nice Christmas, gets you to that place that sets you up right for the holiday period, absolutely.
Absolutely, that's what it does.
Why not? Enough of this revelry and enjoyment. We've got some Doctor Who to talk about. No, enough of all this. Pay attention, 00s. Type 40 is part of the Fandom Podcast Network, and we must observe a couple of those fixed points here in a what's a microfilm that's been sent from head office. Each and every edition of our show, past, present, and future, is easily found on the FPNet master feed. There, I'm back in the swing of this already. At fpnet.podbean.com and FPNet on the Podbean app. The Fandom Podcast Network's also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, and as of now, new for 2020, we're on the popular podcast streaming platform iHeartRadio.
We'll get you.
I don't know what it is. If you're hearing us for the first time on iHeartRadio, we're over the moon to be here and that you're there. And if you like what you hear, get in touch. Stick with us. How do you get in touch? Well, that's our social media presence. That's how. It's Instagram and Twitter at Type 40 Doctor Who. Plus, there's real time talk and shares daily with our wonderful companions of all generations and regenerations in the ever lively Type 40 Facebook group. Over 1,000 members there, growing by the week, lots of great content, and our regular polls, particularly on these new stories, as they're rolling out. You'll be hearing some of those opinions a little later on in the show. But if you'd like to get on board and contribute, get stuck in with all that. There are links to all of it in the show notes. Sarah, deep undercover on social media, where can other agents liaise with you?
I love that you said liaise. You can find me. I've simplified it even more. It's now Starry. That's my name. Starry at Starry Eyed Girl.
We'll be down to two or three letters soon, won't we? There we are, Starry-Eyed Girl, at Starry. Simon, our man in the field. When you're not free running across a Brazilian rooftop to secure a flash drive from an insurgent, have you got time for social media? And if so, where can people locate you?
Well, they can indeed locate me if they want to. If you're going to come find me, go and have a look on Facebook under Doctor Who, the Whonatics, Whonatics. And you will find me lurking there. And it's always helpful if you bring along a pot of invisible ink as well, and maybe a laser-guided shoe, and I don't know.
There is where these things are going.
Absolutely.
You've got to think on your feet, haven't you? Well, shoot from your feet.
Well, hey.
We'll come to that in a little while. And I can be reached on Instagram and Twitter as The Spacebook, talking about all things inside and outside of the TARDIS, such as that new Star Wars film and the TV show The Mandalorian, most recently, that Simon's been talking about. There's the upcoming Marvel and DC films later on in the year, and that new Bond film, come to think of it, we all love a bit of Bond. So yeah, that's all kicking off in the Spacebook Facebook group daily. Come and find us. Come and have a chat. You'll be most welcome. Yeah, let's not keep the listeners waiting any longer with all our stuff and nonsense. Open the file labelled Spyfall. It's a two-part story that launched this new run of Doctor Who, beginning on New Year's Day, and then it continued the following Sunday evening. After a whole calendar year away from the screens, Doctor Who returned. This is how it rolled out. This is the synopsis. Intelligence agents around the world are under attack from alien forces. So M16 turns to the only people who can help, as the Doctor and friends. As the team travels the globe looking for answers, attacks come from all sides. Earth's security rests on their shoulders. But where will this planet-threatening conspiracy lead them? This is Spyfall Part 1. That was the synopsis for, written by Chris Chibnall, directed by Jamie Magnus Stone. What a great name. Starred Jodie Whittaker, of course, with Bradley Walsh, Tosin Cole, Mandeep Gill. even though this is a two-parter and both parts were screened quite close together and featured most of the same cast, both written by Chris Chibnall, they do kind of feel like games of two halves. So, you know, we'll try and sort of stay on the ball a little bit as we talk about it, because they're made in two separate production blocks, which I did wonder about this. Shot a few weeks apart by two different directors in wildly different locations. So it's open to discussion whether that makes for a true two-parter or not. Because it did mean they felt like slightly different beasts. Simply put, Sarah, Spyfall, straight out the bat, does it feel to you like Doctor Who's back?
No. Well, yes and no. When it first started, I liked the pre-credit sequence.
That was nice. Yeah.
And it felt like Doctor Who again for a few moments. I like that we started with the companions and
set the scene.
They seemed a tiny bit more fleshed out.
It gets deep into the action quite fast, yeah, though, doesn't it? The story kicks off quite fast.
I was interested in the story. It was an interesting premise. I liked it. I was intrigued. I liked all the MI6 stuff in the car, and I was pretty happy until we got to MI6. And we got the upgrade line, and that just completely took me out of it.
This is a line that's had pretty much everybody talking. You know, I feel that, you know, it's probably right to come to that first, because to not do so would probably be burying the lead, really, because I think that divided the audience right away. You know, rightly or wrongly, if you're listening to this, you may have found that completely harmless, whatever else. This is the line, isn't it, where the Doctor and her friends are taken to meet the head of MI6C, as played by Stephen Fry. He sort of looks them all across and assumes that Graham is the Doctor, makes that assumption. We have an awkward silence before the Doctor pushes away to the front and says, you know, that, oh, it's me, I've had an upgrade. That sends very clear signals, doesn't it, to everybody watching of either gender. Yeah, I think it left a bad taste in a lot of people's mouths, pushed a significant number of them away. And that hits sore point with you as well, Sarah, obviously.
Yeah, because it didn't need to be there. I've mentioned it before, but...
So quickly as well.
It did nothing to move the scene along. The time it took for that little bit of dialogue that could have been something else. And I keep getting fed up with this thing about women being better than men. It's a real bugbear that I've got, and it wasn't necessary.
The action was just starting, wasn't it? You know, we've been reintroduced to these characters. The premise was being set up. We're taken to this not exactly exotic location, but quite an impressive sort of scene.
And it all kind of just
immediately takes us there.
It skidded to a halt.
It immediately exposes sort of the wounds, the raw tissue from 10 weeks of that kind of thing, really, last season. Simon, this scene with you, I mean, I hope you don't mind me bring this up now, you know, I hope you don't mind me mentioning this, but you watched Series 11, you began Series 11 with quite an open mind, didn't you?
That's correct.
You didn't make it beyond a certain point in the series.
Episode 4, was the last one, yeah.
You've returned to the show, returned to the bench very much for us with, again, in the best sense that you could, to try and come to it with an open mind, with fresh eyes. So when you heard that line, how was the opening for you? Did that affect you in any way? Did that affect your enjoyment?
Undoubtedly. Like Sarah says, it literally ground to a halt for me. To be honest, I was struggling with it up until that point anyway. There are a number of issues around the opening that I had problems with. I was bored with it, I have to be honest. For the first half an hour of the entire first episode, I was just bored. It wasn't particularly bad. It was just nothing. I was just bored. I was frustrated as to... I'm supposed to buy the fact that MI6 need Ryan and I can't even remember their names. They're so bland.
Graham.
What are the names? Is Ryan
Graham
and
Yaz.
Thank you. Are you seriously asking me to believe that MI6 need those three characters? Okay, I might just about be able to buy that they need the Doctor. Are you seriously telling me MI6 cannot solve this problem without Graham, Ryan and Yaz. Seriously? And they go to them first before the Doctor. You're having a laugh. I'm sorry. So I was already on a hiding to nothing with the episode. But then this line comes in and there's so much going on in that line because basically it's sticking two fingers up at people, and I include myself in this, fans that have been vocal about the fact that they feel the Doctor is a male and should remain a male in exactly the same way. And I'm going to deliberately put a rider in here in the same way that I feel Ripley in the Alien films is a female and should always remain female. So I'm not misogynistic. I just feel that the Doctor mm-hmm. is a male. But they put it was a deliberate two fingers up to the likes of us who have been outspoken about that. It was also two fingers up to the people, again, like myself, that said, looking at those early photos of season 11 before season 11 had even aired, and we saw the photos of the four of them together, Team TARDIS, as they irritatingly like to call it now, and a lot of people were saying the dynamic looks wrong. It looks like Graham should be the Doctor. And the fact is, that's because it's true. Graham does look like he should be the Doctor. So again, it was two fingers up at the viewers that had stated that.
It was bang on the nose.
Bang on the nose. And the final thing that just basically puts a tin hat on it for me, because it encapsulates what was wrong with this episode. And I will come to what I thought was right with the episode, because whatever, I don't know if I can use the word, it was an improvement on the season 11, but it was definitely a very, very different beast to season 11. So there was stuff that I liked. So we are kind of starting off with negative stuff, but my main problem that I had with the episode was its smugness. It literally drips smug. The whole episode, the performances, the script, everything drips smugness. And that line about the upgrade was just, it was done in such a smug, offhand way to insult the casual viewer, that if you can't,
because there are lots of ways that you could have written that one line, aren't there, that could have been a lot more inclusive than that. It could have been just as wry, just as
well. I don't know if you saw it around social media. It isn't the first time that line's been used. Missy used it in The Witch is Familiar.
Yes,
I don't remember that. Okay,
but that's well, whether you think she's the master or not, that suits Missy. Because we already know what her character's like, and
She's cruel.
She's cruel. She does embrace her femininity, which is,
and she's a sociopath.
Yeah,
But maybe this doctor's a sociopath too.
But the way this was written, like it's like Simon was saying, it was smug. It was clever.
It was self-satisfied. They were really pleased with that line. Yeah. You could literally see them sitting there congratulating themselves over how brilliant that line was.
It was completely unnecessary within the realms of the story that they were telling. I think that there was, as you said, Simon, you said you were bored, and yet there was so much going on. It did start with a great head of steam and a statement of intent, sort of conceptually. There was a certain, I mean, I'm not sure how Bondy it actually was, but obviously it did play on the whole aspect to something being brought before the head of the department like that. The idea that they would require, you know, we can't have this mission. We can't possibly do this mission without the bus driver, the part-time policewoman,
and the kid who can't ride a bicycle,
and the other one. Yeah, and so there is maybe they felt the Doctor being the Doctor, the Doctor may need some leverage somewhere along the way. If they got his friends involved, then maybe he would come to the party too. And I'm going to say he, because I think the Doctor still considers himself a he. But we'll come to that later.
What did you think to that first shot with the TARDIS on the ramp in the garage? Because I thought it looked good, but that's all it was. Then when I actually started to think about it, and there's been so much going off on Twitter about it.
Well, obviously that was before the upgrade line, wasn't it?
It didn't feel, I don't know, maybe it's just me, but I don't like the idea of seeing pipes and things underneath the box, because to me the tinkering is more inside.
Well, I think it's interesting you say that, Sarah, and it's interesting you use the word tinkering there, because this again is part of the problem for me. It's this constant tinkering with the format in whatever form it is, whether it's wiping Gallifrey out of existence again, whether it's getting tubes coming out of the TARDIS that weren't there previously. It's all this stuff. It's this tinkering with the format that bugs me. It's one of the things that bug me. We're losing the purity of the idea that they came up with in 1963. And that idea worked for 50 years. We can't actually say that. It probably worked for about 24 years before Andrew Cartmell came along and began to mess with the format. Mm. But it had certainly worked for 20-odd years. And there's a reason why, and so I kick against this constant tinkering. You don't need to reinvent the wheel. Doctor Who works because it's Doctor Who.
Well, it loses the mystique as well. I mean, yes, on the outside it looks like a box, but it isn't a box, we all know. And
you don't want to see the mechanics of how it's working.
No,
I don't want the question even being raised in a way. Fine, do mysterious stuff with it, but I don't want to know the mechanics of how it might or might not
work. It's like seeing behind the curtain in The Wizard of Oz.
Exactly.
Backstage at Willy Wonka's factory.
And especially coming on the back of, especially Matt Smith's era, when we went back to that kind of wonder and fantasy. Yeah, I don't want to see it all open on display. I like it. I like that mystery. We'll get to it anyway, but I feel like, yet again, instead of moving forward, writers just seem to want to go back and mess about with everything and go back to the Doctor. And the Doctor's a mystery. I just want to move forward and have adventures.
Basic elements of what make up the average Doctor Who story and the energy of it, right the way back from day one. In this instance, I don't think Chris Chibnall's thinking necessarily that far back. However, he is absolutely thinking back to 2005. And the overriding thing about this is this massive reconnection, if you like, an attempt to immediately sort of make for that part of the viewing audience that remembers the heyday of the Russell T Davies era, where everybody, seemed that everybody in the country, not only watched Doctor Who, but loved Doctor Who, certainly knew what it was on board with it. The calling cards of that era, an attempt to evoke that time, to hit those beats, and to do signature things that Russell T Davies would do. And talking about this scene with the TARDIS, I can see myself playing devil's advocate quite a lot as regards this, because I didn't necessarily like it any more than you do. However, that scene with the TARDIS up on the in the garage, up on the thingy. You can see I'm a mechanically minded person. up on the ramps. When it's up on the ramps, you know, it was like for 20 seconds. But that initial moment, it's a big visual statement, a quirky idea. It's something that, as a cartoonist, I would draw that as a cartoon. And I think that's the way that Russell T Davies, that was very much the way that he viewed Doctor Who, exactly the kind of visual that he would have given. That contrast of the environment to the situation, and to show the TARDIS in that way, and pulling the wires out from it and everything, and the Doctor's there with those goggles on. And there is an angle of that, and I got a little bit of heat on Twitter for mentioning this, but I'm going to mention it again anyway. There's a little angle to that that sort of connects back to the whole feminism thing, because obviously a workshop, a garage, is a traditionally man.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Environment. It's like, anything no I can do, you can do better.
Yeah. And it's that whole poster with the woman in the overalls with her hair up in a knot at the top, flexing a muscle. I haven't necessarily got an issue with that. I think that can be quite fun. And I personally thought that visual was quite fun. I didn't mind it at all, partly because I think my view of the show and of these cornerstones and of Doctor Who in an energetic way, my look at it, my take on it was always similar to Russell T Davies, so I always liked these things. But it does come with that slight aftertaste. And then I think to myself, going back through the decades, you know, for a while, John Pertwee's Doctor had the TARDIS console outside of the box. We have seen little things like this here and there, and they never appear again. And so in the grand context of things, maybe we shouldn't chew through these things quite so much. But it's not, I think the problem is, and why we could come across as seeing a bit, as seeming and sounding a little churlish, is because it isn't just one thing, is it, Simon? And that's the thing.
That I think is exactly the problem. So I mean, I have to be perfectly honest. I hadn't really. I can't even remember the opening shots with this TARDIS in on the ramps that you're talking about. I literally cannot remember it. I remember later on in the episode when they pick the Doctor up. She's
the direction was a little bland to a lot of that that's
so. So to be honest, I'm not actually picking fault with that particular issue, but I am using it as an example of where I feel they are tinkering with the format more than it should be. And as I mentioned just now, I will be just as critical personally of the Cartmel years when they tinkered with that format as well too much. I didn't like all this business about the Doctor is more than just a Time Lord. I didn't like it. I'm not interested in it. I've said this so many times. I just want Doctor Who to be a rollicking good story where the Doctor lands on a planet, doesn't know where he is, and again, I use the masculine very specifically there, doesn't know where he is, has to use his wits, not his sonic screwdriver, to solve things, get zapped out a few times by some ugly aliens and escapes. Okay, I'm oversimplifying. Of course I am. I don't want every episode to be like that. Caves of Androzani is not like that, for example, and it's one of my favourite stories. But you take the point I'm making, which is that to me is what Doctor Who is about. I'm just not interested in this tinkering with the format to change things. So, yes, you're right, Dan, in that this isn't, it isn't just about a TARDIS up on ramps. It's about something far more intrinsic and far more deep-rooted than that, that it just isn't working for me. Personally, that, you know, the fact remains, at the moment, what we are getting on a Sunday night called Doctor Who is not Doctor Who. It's a programme called Doctor Who. Fine. If people are really enjoying it, brilliant. I'm really pleased for you. I'm not trying to undermine that or knock it at all, but it simply isn't. It isn't for me true Doctor Who. I feel like I'm watching a spin-off show called The TARDIS Family or something like that for a 5 o'clock audience, for teenagers. That's what I feel I'm looking at. And all these horrific mentions of the Doctor's fam literally just make me want to scream when she says about her fam. I don't know who they're making it for. They're definitely making it for younger people than me.
It makes me grit my teeth too. I have to say, you expect things to be modernised up to a point, don't you, Sarah? Is there a way, do you think, to modernise in that sense and to make something feel contemporary, but not to throw the baby out with the bath?
Yeah, it's called good writing.
Well done, Sarah.
I'm sorry, no, because I don't mind the fam thing particularly, but if it's, it doesn't feel genuine because I just feel...
It doesn't sound authentic.
Yeah,
there's no point
that's
to
the
it.
Word, that's the word I was looking for. I don't feel invested at these as a family. A Doctor Who family was 11, Amy and Rory and River. That's a TARDIS family. Oh,
Ian, Barbara, Susan.
Ian, Barbara,
and the
Susan.
Tegan, Adric, Nyssa, the Fifth Doctor. Those are kind of families.
Even, I suppose, you know, with the Doctor, Rose, Jack, Mickey, Jackie to some extent. Yeah. That's a family.
And what are the common things between all those casts that we've just talked about that's different between the cast that we've got presently? It's because they argued, they fell out, they disagreed quite regularly, they railed and rallied against one another, they formed little sort of, not allegiances, but they had different kind of conversations between them, and they didn't just trail along behind the Doctor like she's some sort of Arkayla, some sort of brown owl, hanging on every word that she says and pretty much agreeing.
And there's a scene later on in that episode, you know, when they're in the hangar and they're going to catch up with the plane, and they do just trot after her like lemmings.
Yeah,
and I laugh.
Yeah,
and it was supposed to be actually a dramatic moment, getting onto this plane, and I laugh.
They are also, they're all, on the one hand, to me, they're all too nice to each other. It's all too chummy. Yeah. It's all too lovely. I feel like I'm being hit over the head with a sledgehammer, pink candy-coated sledgehammer, because it's so gorgeous, and they're all such wonderful people. They're all so lovely to each other, and they're all there for each other. I'm like, oh, please, pass the sick bucket. To me, it's not believable. And unfortunately, for me, The companion characters are simply not well-rounded enough and not well-written enough. It's ironic because on the one hand, they've gone out of the way to give all these characters these different character traits that are supposed to make them more grounded and more realistic. And actually,
they've been conceived by committee, haven't they? I don't like to use phrases like box ticking, because that does make one come over of a certain mindset.
Yes.
But
to an extent, it is box ticking. But as I say, even more than that, as I say, it's the irony that on the one hand, they're supposed to be more realistic characters, and actually, they're less realistic. simply because you can see them being engineered to, okay, well, this one is going to have this particular character trait. That, as you say, Dan, we're back to box ticking.
Yeah, I wasn't talking about ethnically.
No,
I wasn't. You know, I meant this is the one who's got that personal quality. And that, you know, that obviously that side to it, the visual side to it, the cultural side to it, I've no doubt is at play. But within, and this is, and what you're just identifying there, Simon, is I think the reason why the dynamic never quite connects and never makes you feel like you're in the presence of real, rounded people.
No, and I think, I mean, if you look at, you know, I use the example there of the Fifth Doctor, Nyssa Teagan and Adric, and whether you like Adric or not, whether you like any of them or not, you watch those stories and, okay, there is an argument that there was too much arguing at that point. But I can believe in those characters. I believe that Adric was an absolute brat around the TARDIS and they did all want to kick him out. I just believe in the characters and I can see that they are more rounded for actually being relatively undefined in comparison with the current team. And so that to me is the irony, that this team is more defined, but actually far less believable and actually less interesting and less entertaining to be with. This is one of the problems I've got with it. I'm not enjoying my time with these people. I don't like them. I don't want to spend any time with them. I don't want to sit down and have a cup of tea with any of them.
Do you believe they are who they say?
No, I don't believe them at all. I don't believe a single one of them, and that includes the Doctor. I just don't believe them.
I mean, Yaz does not come across as a police officer, even in training.
Not in the slightest.
What is she hasn't used... This would have been a really good example of this episode of her to use some of her policing skills.
Spot on.
I mean, you remember, like, we had Sarah Jane used the journalist skills, we had Rory. You know, there's so many stories where Rory would go and look after somebody because his nursing kicked in.
Or Mark, that innate side to his nature.
Or Martha Jones, you know, obviously, you know, being a... I completely believe that Martha Jones was a doctor in training.
Did you feel that they were walking back a little bit of this with Yaz? Because she's gone from being, as far as I was aware, a full policewoman who was on the verge. She was pushing for promotion when the last series started. Now she's kind of, not a PCSO, but she's, like you say, she's sort of like in training and very on, not on probation. What was the expression they used? And that wasn't the impression that I got last year. That she was like the brightest and the best upcoming last year. Maybe I need to watch these things again, because I'll be honest, I didn't rewatch Series 11 at all. So maybe it's my memory playing tricks on me. But I did feel that they walked this back a little bit. Maybe it is partly so that we can know her and relate to her a little closer. Maybe that's the idea. I don't know. I think Mandip Gill is a good actress, and I think she deserves better than this material.
Yeah. I agree. And same with Tosin Cole. I think he is better. I do like Bradley Walsh because I think he's the only one that's in any way relatable. But I would relate to him more. Why has nobody turned on the Doctor and said, this is your fault? I mean, so far, he lost his wife because of the Doctor. It is true. And they never... there's a wonderful moment in The Sound of Drums, and I'm going to keep bringing this up because this was part like a rip-off.
Exactly. This is one of the many Russell T. Davies episodes that they tried
angry,
to make into this.
How angry was Martha? She rounded on the 10th Doctor, dragging her family into it. It weren't safe. Yeah. We saw no consequences of that. And why am I...
It's all jolly hockey sticks.
I think also one of the fundamental problems for me, and this actually goes back to Clara Oswald as a character, I don't think it works, basically, when... these characters have a life outside the TARDIS. The whole point, again, going back to the original format, these people got whisked up in the TARDIS, sometimes by choice, sometimes not. And so for that period, they were in the TARDIS. So you felt a connection that they were connected to the TARDIS, to the Doctor. They were in this for the long run until they were jettisoned for whatever reason. All this business about, you know, going back...
Do you think the isolation of that setup had a certain romance to it?
Well, it's not only the romance. It has a certain tension, a certain dramatic quality. When I keep seeing them just going back to their boring old domestic life, I'm like, I'm not interested in that boring domestic yeah. life that they keep going back to. It's not interesting. It's not exciting. It's not fun to watch. I haven't. You could be watching a scene out of Hollyoaks or Coronation Street or something. And there's a reason why I don't watch those programmes, because they're boring. So I don't want to go back to that. But then, as I say, it just lifts the character and then it lifts me out of the drama. Public, the viewer has always been intended to connect and identify with the companion. So if they're constantly just going back home for Sunday lunch or whatever it is, then it lifts them out of the drama. Why then do they go back to the doctor? I don't. So you're left thinking, okay, why are MI6 picking on those three people to go and pick up? Why don't they go and pick up Tegan, for example? Why don't they go and pick up...
Kate, at the very least, Kate Lethbridge-Stewart.
Anybody.
Yeah, Osgood.
Anybody. Osgood. They're as good a candidate to pick up as the three that happen to be travelling with the Doctor. But they don't really happen to be travelling with the Doctor because it's all on such an ad hoc basis. Mm. So it just doesn't work for me because it destroys the connectivity of those people. It doesn't help them build. They need to be in the TARDIS for the long run until they're no longer there.
I think by this point they definitely do. Yeah, and Sarah, you came to this with the Russell T Davies era, and I do want to stand up for the... I think it can work when you return to their day-to-day lives. When I watched the show as a child, I liked that isolation angle to it, but I did also really appreciate when they started going back to the everyday lives and things in 2005. I think it worked very, very well. But the writing, you have to be absolutely certain. And you have to be absolutely certain of your characters, of who they are to one another, even more so. And you have to... absolutely have to have a story more worth telling than ever, and to have a literate quality to it that's going to reflect the main body of the entire piece. Sarah, that was very much what brought you into Doctor Who, was the impression that I got.
Yeah, well, again, it goes with the writing, and Russell T Davies had a definite direction and wanted to answer these questions. I remember, in the second episode, Rose has that sudden realisation, oh my God, I'm in space with this man. I don't know him. Yeah. Is he a man? Well, she knows he's not. He's an alien. And there's that wonderful scene where they have that argument. And then obviously then they go back. And I remember watching Doctor Who Confidential. Oh, missed that show. And RTD's all reasoning about episodes 4 and 5 were because, you know, you just went in the TARDIS and that was it. You know, what happens? Do people miss the people? What goes on? And we had that lovely thing where Rose goes home and it's a year later. But again, I agree with Simon in that if you keep going back,
Because what you've just talked about, that setup does dovetail with everything that Simon's just, that you were just saying, Simon, as a virtue of that fundamental...
Absolutely. But the thing is to note here, all of those Russell T Davies stories, Father's Day, Agents of London, any that you want to mention, there was a reason why they went back to Rose's life. Whereas in this particular, in Spyfall, there was no reason whatsoever to start with a load of filler material where they're all going on about, oh, haven't you been missed from work? Oh, it's just rubbish. I'm not interested. No, just hit the ground running. Back in the day, it's certainly in classic era Doctor Who, not quite sure how they would have handled it in RTD's era. I'd have to think about that one. But in classic era Doctor Who, what would have happened is that the Doctor, that it would have started in the console room of the TARDIS, and the Doctor would have said, oh my goodness, the Brigadier needs me. I've got to get back to help Unit out. And they'd have all gone back. So there's no need to mess about with this very banal everyday life stuff about talking about how many assignments have you had this year. I don't care. Nobody actually cares. So the Russell T Davies stuff is very, very different because every time there was a reason why he took them back to modern day and to Rose's family, there was a reason for it.
You talk about reasons and purpose. Was there actually any real reasoning or purpose towards Spyfall? God, I've been doing that all week. Spyfall. No joke. Really, really, Chris. Was this so necessary to make it so close and make it so on the nose of the title? Yeah. Think of us. Think of us that are Bond fans and Doctor Who fans.
Well,
yeah. But was there a purpose to this? Dramatically, the only purpose to the entirety of certainly Spyfall Part 1 was to chug along and chug along and chug along and get us to a cliffhanger. Everything else leading up to it was what I would call a very broad caper. Nothing more, nothing less. There was, you know, you said yourself, Simon, you got bored with it. You know, Sarah, you described it was just a lot of people running along behind the main character across various, you know, across airfields or whatever else. You know, it was a lot of breathless running around, overacting. I hate to say it, not necessarily a bad thing. Doctor Who's been a mecca for overacting over the years, for better or worse, and for broad strokes. The whole thing about, you know, Bond parody, this was billed very much as it was going to be Bondian, and it would chime with that. There wasn't that many publicity photographs after all, but we did get a couple that were Bond flavored. Sagan Akinola brought in a little bit of the Bond theme into his score in a couple of places here and there during part one, and we did get introduced to various strings to it. You see, I think that caper and something superficial is actually reasonable territory for Doctor Who to play in. You know, it's done so before with great effect. It's been tremendously enjoyable, particularly on Christmas Day. There's been a lot of caper episodes, which have been very, very analogue from A to B to C to D. You know, even looking back to stories of the John Pertwee era, I mean, Planet of the Spiders had an entire 25-minute portion of that set aside to just run around and have a giggle. I don't mind that particularly on a public holiday. Here comes the but. But it has got to make some sort of sense with its own internal logic, internal being, and make it feel like you've sort of taken in something that's substantial. Was it really that Bond in flavour, Simon? Well, because I didn't feel very Bond-y.
I mean, I would totally agree with you. Doctor Who can be just a caper, and some of my favourite stories could be described as just capers. So yeah, I don't have a problem with that at all. And I don't necessarily have a problem with them sort of going down or saying, oh yeah, let's do a Bond pastiche kind of thing. I don't have a problem with that. The problem I have with it, and this literally is one of confusion, and maybe you guys can answer these questions for me, because I just genuinely couldn't, ultimately, by the end of episode two, I still couldn't get this. I couldn't understand why we were talking about spies in the first place. Why was it? Why was it that the point I'm making is it begins to feel like they just came up with the idea, well, let's do a Bond pastiche. Right, how are we going to do this? So can you please explain to me, why were spies being targeted in the first place? Why was it in that first bit, the whole big thing, was about this spy from the plane that had somehow been turned into a non-human, but they couldn't analyse it, they didn't know what it was. What was all that about, ultimately? What had she been turned into? What was she?
It was all pretense, though, wasn't it? Pretense in the real world sense. As a production, it was a pretense, just to keep eyes on screen. And nice, bright, shiny.
Laughing here.
Nice, bright, shiny things. Lots and lots of running around.
Colour, get it, shape.
Get it. It's Bond.
Colour,
it's
shape,
Bond.
Movements.
It was that constantly all the way through. And to, just like I say, to keep the audience's attention for that whole hour with a promise of a payoff and a reward that didn't really ever appear. Looking at the situation, I think of Bond movies. I love Bond movies. I know you love Bond movies.
Absolutely.
I think Sarah, you've got a soft spot for them.
I love Bond movies, yeah.
There was a couple of scenes in this. You know, they did break up the cast a little. We got a setup where Yaz and Ryan were deployed to go and speak to the Bond villain of the piece, and they were put into that situation where they were sort of skulking around his office trying to retrieve information and things. There was a bit of tension in the air there. Again, for somebody who was a policewoman, you know, it was difficult to see those qualities come there in that. They did bring some fragility from Yaz in the first episode at various points, you know, where she gets, because she's the first one that gets taken to the Upside Down, isn't she? Into the Stranger Things parody. And I thought that was quite a nice scene when we see her sort of come back through the other side, however convenient that was. It's just a magic door, really. We saw her come out the other side, you know, and we see her take 5 minutes and shed a couple of tears. I would have liked to have seen a little more of that. And if you had fewer companions, there'd be a lot more time to revisit that. You know, maybe have left her there for a little longer, had her come out with a certain amount of, if not PTSD, then a certain amount of trauma, residual trauma. But they needed the story to move and move and move and move so that they, you know, we didn't sit around and think about
that. Yeah, she just sprung back from it and it'll never be talked about again because she was perfectly fine.
going back to the Bond thing, we did go to Daniel Barton's birthday party at one point, didn't we? Which is like a casino set up. I don't know about you. I've been to a couple of sort of Bond-like theme parties over the years. I've never seen anything look less Bondian in my entire life. That croupier, she'd got to have been 60 if she was a day, bless her. And everybody...
Now you're being ageist. You'll be accused
everybody,
of it.
Everybody... this is, I mean, you know, to evoke Bond, though, it was just that, but to evoke Bond, turn the lights down.
Yeah.
You have the vodka martinis out. Mandip Gill is the only female companion. Okay, what she was dressed in was probably practical for doing a run around on the airfield, but why wasn't she in a nice gown?
Because you can't wear pretty gowns in 2020, Dan, because that's feminine.
Yes.
And feminine's weak.
Yeah, you can't
exactly.
do that.
What's so wrong with femininity? If I'm to accept that the Doctor is this, you know, and I'm going to, again, try and step back from my own feeling about the situation. If I have to accept the Doctor as this sort of sprite-like character who's almost, as Kyle Wagner pointed out, you know, quite a viable point, but who views themselves as almost genderless, and it's irrelevant what physical gender is on the outside. They will put on the clothes, they will live the part, they will step into that world, they'll have a bit of fun. I like that scene, for example. I liked this scene and this moment, again, this is two moments I liked, where the Doctor was playing cards and saying, hit me with a card, hit me, and then laid down that final card and shouted snap. To me, that's the Doctor. That's absolutely something the Doctor would do. I thought that was a nice moment. And I thought it was something that genuinely came right from the centre of Jodie Whittaker. And the reason why it stands out is because we do get so little of the real, authentic Jodie Whittaker come through in this performance, whereas every other actor that's played it before has done that. You know, John Pertwee, Tom Baker, Peter Capaldi, time after time after time, so few of them have been performances in this level. And none of them have been this self-conscious and this minded on agenda.
There's definitely.
And so when we get moments like that, I did like it. I think if you're going to parody Bond, in a time where everybody else has already parodied Bond, and I did sigh a little when I heard about the band Bond parody, not because I felt they would hurt my beloved Bond in any way, but just because I thought, are there any jokes left to tell? But of course, for children watching, Sarah, your children's age and younger, this could be the first Bond parody they ever see. So putting that to one side. But if you're going to do it with a bit of gusto. You know, you can change people in and out of costumes like they do in Bond movies.
I was going to say one of the main things that they tried to make Bondian was all with the gadgets. Absolutely no explicable reason whatsoever. MI6 are now going to entrust these three. Okay, again, maybe you can get it with the Doctor, but they're going to entrust these three complete idiots who they've never met before. They don't know a thing about. We're going to give them laser shoes and goodness knows what else. Are you serious? So this is just stretching my credibility. It's like you said, Dan. The show has got to have an internal logic. The instant reaction to that will be somebody say, oh, you believe that they can fly around the time and space in a blue box, but you can't imagine that MI6 are going to give them laser shoes. Well, no, there are certain things that transcend that realism. But then the show itself has got to work in its own context, within its own world. And I just don't believe MI6 would entrust them with that kind of technology. 10 times worse than that is then when it just culminates in that literally excruciating shootout business with the heavies that come to pick them up at the phone box, and Graham starts kicking his heels with laser bolts shooting out. I'm literally now losing the will to live. It is so embarrassing. And it's so appallingly directed and so appallingly edited. It was literally, I wanted to pluck out my own eyeballs and eat them.
It did look strangely flat in the way that television...
I think you're being kind, Dan.
In the way that children's television can sometimes look a little flat. I don't know where... Most of this seemed to me...
You're right, it looked like kids' TV.
Yeah, and most of the... we have to acknowledge here that... Every time they told us that we were abroad, be it Australia, at one point it was supposed to be, not San Francisco, Los Angeles, sorry.
It was all South Africa,
which I don't mind.
No, I don't have a problem with that. But looks good.
Ambience, the Australia stuff did actually look like
Australia. Yeah, it looks good. It all looks good.
But a lot of those other scenes, you know, but ironically, it was the scenes in the UK that looked the worst, looked the least convincing. And that in particular, I thought there was a missed opportunity here with Bond. if you're going to do it better, do it properly, to divide up those sort of Bondian roles of Q, Moneypenny and Felix Leiter, say, each of those characters, we're going to have four companions, let them play in those roles. You don't have to make the older grey-haired male the Q. You know, maybe Yaz could have had all the kit. Maybe Ryan could have been the bit of glamour on the Doctor's arm. Who knows? They could have played with it all in so much more of a fun way. But I think it's because, ultimately, the Bond stuff was there in a very cursory way to hang Spyfall Part 1, to hang it on some peg or another so they could get through to that cliffhanger. And I'm not against something being thin plotted, but I think if it's not about plot, it has to be about characters. And this was ultimately neither.
It's ironic, actually, because I think this would actually have done better. I know we're going to talk about ratings later. This kind of thing would have worked for Christmas Day as a bit of light entertainment.
Well, they always put a Bond film on Christmas Day on ITV, don't they? Every year.
I think you're right, actually, Sarah. I think this would have worked a lot better if you'd just done it as a self-contained Bond caper for Christmas, just a real bit of throwaway disposable fun. I think it would have worked a lot better, but trying to add on all of the heavy connotations that we will come to, and you know, this whole groundbreaking new direction that Doctor Who's going, it felt very heavy. Are we doing this ridiculous, laughable pantomime with Graham with a laser shoe kicking off, or are we doing something far more hard-hitting and serious and dramatic? And so, to me, it was trying to do both things and failed ultimately in both, because of the fact it was trying to do them both together.
Yeah, I think it feels like it doesn't. This episode and the next one, it didn't feel organic to me.
I'd agree.
I think there were certain points that it wanted to hit. And I'm talking about Chibnall here, and then he's just hung it.
Filled in the gaps in between, almost. Yeah.
Did it feel like a two-part story to you guys?
No.
Really. It did feel stylistically different. I mean, I suppose in Doctor Who's past, again, we've had four-part stories that have had a bit of a break in the middle that have felt, you know, the Stones of Blood's a prime example.
Yeah, there's loads. I don't think I necessarily have a problem if it does feel as two single-parters that are kind of just thematically linked. I don't have a problem. Mm. As long as they're good stories, it doesn't worry me.
Well, I think the choice of different directors for each one,
that's odd,
might jar a little, because there was something different about it in that respect, I think, visually.
I actually thought at one point when part two started, because I thought, well, how are they going to go through all this in one episode? I wondered if this was the theme of the series and it was going to be like episodic, like Classic Who. I wondered if we was going to get some time with the companions having to be on the run, like for a few more episodes, and then we'd find out what the Doctor was doing, and then it'd come back to maybe with the lesser episode count as well. But I do think there were good things.
It would be a way to examine what's not just what brought those characters together, we know that, but what's keeping them together, because we don't really see a great deal of that. It's never really been questioned until very late in the day or in that episode, come to think of it. I think that's probably too clever. I think it's too nuanced.
It would have been interesting to see, you know, how does the Doctor get back to the time, and how do the companions survive? Because, to be honest, there weren't any stakes. I mean, with Sound of Drums and Lost of the Time Lords, it did feel like the companions had been put through the ringer. I mean, again, I know a lot was told, especially about Martha Jones and that year. Obviously, you can't fit it all in a two-part story, but they still showed more in that two-part story than they did in this one.
Did nobody else sort of get the feeling that it was just told at such a sort of breakneck speed that they couldn't actually keep up with it anyway? By the end of it, I have to be honest, I was really confused. I hadn't got a clue ultimately what was going on, and I felt we descended back to that sort of Stephen Moffat timey-wimey sort of paradoxal stuff. I hadn't got a clue
It was Chibnall trying to tell that kind of story in that kind of way. And for all that we may complain and sort of backhanded compliment with Stephen Moffat, and we know that he tangled himself in knots more than a couple of times, for all that is true, Chris Chibnall is nowhere near the level of writer that Stephen Moffat is. And so for him to try and do that too and bring that in and play in the same sandpit, very foolhardy. It's exposed all of his failings as a writer. I'm sure he has got virtues as a writer. Say, I've enjoyed several of his other shows over the years.
Me too.
But for some reason, he doesn't seem to want to play on these strings.
Yeah.
I think it's because, well, I don't think he can anymore. I think it's down to the wire with Doctor Who now. It's clearly make or break. They sent a whole portion of the audience away last time. Here they are trying to woo us back. And the fastest way to do that is a shed load. I was going to swear then. A shed load of continuity. Lots and lots of callbacks and stuff what we've seen before, and to simply think, oh, what would Russell T Davies do? What would Stephen Moffat do? What do we know the audience liked before?
There's definitely a feeling of panic there, I feel, in the background, as in they, whether they admit it or not, they know season 11 was, being diplomatic here, was not as successful as they would have liked it to have been. Mm-hmm. They know that. And so there's definitely feeling, and obviously this is one of the best aspects of Spyfall for me, was it was very, very different to anything in season 11, certainly that I saw. As I say, whether it was an improvement, I would literally have to think a long time about. But it was very different, and that's the good thing about it. But there is definitely a feeling that they are panicking a bit behind the scenes. They don't quite know what to do, so they just tried something different. So on the one hand, it was an improvement simply because it was different to season 11, which drove me away. And whether you like it or not, it had more of a story and more going on than a lot of what, again, I saw in season 11. So, but there is still a feeling of desperation. They just don't quite know what they need to do with it.
Mm-hmm. Under all of it, I think there's about three different, could be decent stories that they packed in. There was what was going on with Daniel Barton, and I still don't, I mean, if you want to talk about Bond, what was his motivation? He was the most one-dimensional villain.
He was appalling.
Well, I think the idea was to give us, you know, the reason they didn't develop him a great deal is because they didn't need to, because 25 feature-length Bond films have developed that character as a trope.
But the problem is, Dan,
it's a shorthand.
But the problem is, as you yourself have just said, if you're going to do Bond, you've got to go for Bond, to go for broke, and so you need a really good Bond villain. And I'm sorry, Lenny Henry was not up to the...
With a Bond villain that's got to have a thing, haven't they, whether they cry blood, whether they've got gold teeth.
Well, they've also got to be able to act well, Dan, let's be honest. Lenny Henry, sorry, was as wooden as a plank for me,
and I think that's part of why part one and part two, for different reasons, but part one in particular started to get very, very dull.
I mean,
because there was nothing potent about it.
Because the idea of about
that dynamic between the Doctor coming when Bond comes face to face with the villain, you anticipate it and you savour it. They meet quite early in the film on one level, usually when Bond's using a pseudonym or something in a different, and it's all very mannered, and then they meet again much later and there's a greater contrast.
Well, yes, because that scene at Barton's house where they meet, it was absolutely appalling. Jodie Whittaker's attempt at being intimidating just meant she just fired questions at him. If you compare that to City of Death or School Reunion with Anthony Head and David Tennant in that swimming pool, that, you know, it was magnetic.
You're quite right. That scene in School Reunion is literally electric. And that's what it needed to be.
That's quite a standard episode. It's not connected to an arc particularly. Anthony Head's character's not especially memorable, but you're right. Both actors stepped to that scene, brought it to life. Because they're very, very good actors. And they were in the correct roles.
Isn't
that hard?
Like Christmas Invasion, because I've been that up because obviously I've watched it recently. Towards the end with Harry and Jones, how David Tennant just turns from being nice to being absolutely livid, and he's scary and intimidating. And It's the eyes, Simon. You're right. You're doing the, and again, and you know, if Jodie's basing her doctor on David Tennant, it can be done. You can go from smiley and warm and quirky to, you know, terrifying, and but she didn't do it.
And unfortunately, I think a lot of this is what I have said for so long about Jodie Whittaker as an actor. She simply doesn't have the gravitas, the weight that somebody like David Tennant has got. She just isn't a heavier weight enough actor for me to pull that off. She's a very lightweight actor. And unfortunately, match her, as I say, with Lenny Henry, who I seriously question why on earth they cast him. He couldn't act. Let's be honest about this. I think he couldn't act. It was embarrassing.
I don't necessarily think he was in the wrong role. I think it was underwritten. And I think that Lenny Henry is a measured and considered actor. I think he can be larger than life. I don't think the script did him any favours.
No,
I agree.
And I think he enjoyed himself. I think he played the part to the best of his ability with the material he was given. And for that, you know, I'm thankful. I've got a lot of time for Lenny Henry. He's a nice man. I think he's very talented. And he's quite rightly very much loved in this country. But yeah, there's something about it.
It just felt flat as a Bond villain.
His motivation was fine. And
what was his motivation?
Good question.
Well, the whole idea about, I mean, they didn't ultimately explore it or take it anywhere.
So
they didn't take it anywhere by which it could reward. What? The whole idea, what they were saying about Google, what they were saying about using us as walking storage devices. Mm. As technology's moved on, like since Bluetooth and since the Poison Sky and stories like that back in the day, that's another thing that this story
the Atmos
off.
Thing,
that Santarin story. God, the Russell T Davies episodes, bang, 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 bang.
Well, I like that. I mean, the stuff about Google and YouTube was bang on point, and there could have been a decent story there.
And you're right, Sarah, they were trying to tell too many stories, because you're right, that would have been a decent story.
If that had been well developed, that would have been a good story and an easy way for the Cybermen to come back.
But then ultimately, the whole thing about Lenny Henry's character in the end, he literally just walked off set, and that was the last we saw of him. Didn't they know what to do with him?
Maybe he's going to turn up again.
Well, okay, then that's fine. But you've still got to end his. You've still got to tie his story up in this particular story. He literally walked off set.
Yeah, and I mean, he just admitted everything he was going to do to that audience who didn't care. Did you notice the extras?
I know.
His role flipped though midway through that, didn't it? He started the piece as the Bond villain.
Yeah.
With everybody around it, with his own henchmen and all that sort of thing. But somewhere around the middle of the thing, he became the henchman, which we're going to come to in a little while. But and by which point, we all know that with Bond villains and the henchmen, you've either got to rip them apart or do something really nasty to them.
What henchmen? Why did you leave his own birthday party? Why didn't he just send the doctor away with his henchmen?
It obviously looks a lot more fun to go herring around the countryside. I mean, the whole bike chase and car chase thing. Yeah, aren't they? They weren't very well shot. I don't think. But and it all felt very, very, very superficial. I think that's the problem with this story. I think you can be lightweight, you can be bouncy, you can be a caper, and not necessarily be superficial. Mm. Going back to something that you've both mentioned this. Mm. In my opinion, this was better than everything that we got in Series 11. This was Chris Chibnall's best episode of Doctor Who that he's managed to put
together. I would agree.
The script, for all that it didn't do, was half decent, and the production had a certain swagger about it and a certain energy, a certain virtue by which, for even though it may have been mauled, to try and bring the audience together again. And I can't be too mean-spirited about that, because some good intention was there, because, you know, their jobs were on the line as well. But ultimately, most of Series 11, or over half of it, wasn't just bad Doctor Who, but it was bad television as well.
Yes.
This was just bad Doctor Who.
Yeah, you're right. It was decent television.
And you know, because it would have amused... I know it did amuse plenty of people. When you deliver something like this, which is a bit more fit for purpose, at least it's recognisably Doctor Who. Mm. You know, it's got the pre-credit sequence, all that sort of thing. It only exposes clearer where there is a weak link, why the production isn't sticking a landing, and where somebody in this particular show, someone very, very crucial, has been miscast. Jodie Whittaker's been miscast as that.
I would agree.
What I agree. And what did it for me was...
That's the big problem. That's why none of this is working.
What sealed it for me was that confrontation scene with Len Hermit. Yeah. And then in part two, when she's on her own...
We've been talking now for a fair while, and most of these problems, when you were talking about that scene in a particular series, hit it home to me. Yeah. All of these problems can be tracked back to that one weak link. Yeah. Because any other actor in this role, any other actor, including somebody who maybe was out of their depth originally, all of them would have brought that to life.
I think Sarah is absolutely spot on that. That scene is key, because if you can imagine, for example, I don't know, Tom Baker, John Pertwee, David Tennant, any of them in the Doctor role at that point in that scene, and I think they would have turned it into something electrifying, whereas unfortunately in Jodie Whittaker's hands, it does come across as desperate, and it ends up with the feeling that she is so much on the back foot, and she hasn't even got a clue that she's on the back foot. She doesn't even realise she's losing, and she still keeps just banging away at a dead horse and doesn't even realise you're left embarrassed for her.
How about Stephen Fry, guys? Stephen Fry's been waiting a long time to be in Doctor Who, hasn't he, Sarah? You know, was it nice to see him in it at last? Do you think that he got a nice role?
No, because I hate it.
It's okay. You've known it to apologise.
No,
it's your honest feeling.
I have been waiting for so many years.
I know you have. That's why I asked you.
And all we got him was him being the voice of the patriarchy. And then he got shot on a...
It was a complete waste of Stephen Fry. If you're going to put him in Doctor Who, I mean, good grief.
But he's brilliant as that kind of authoritative person. I can see why they put him as head of MI6.
Or plummy-voiced quivering chin.
He could have... What a waste.
Complete waste. They could clearly either only afford him for one afternoon or he was only prepared to do one afternoon. But as a result, just don't...
He's a very busy man, Simon.
But as a result... You don't put him in. It's insulting to me to put Stephen Fry in and kill him off within 2 minutes. It's literally insulting to Stephen Fry as an actor, I think. Because you're right, ultimately you're just left with the feeling that he's wasted in the part. So don't do it.
Going back to Spyfall Part 1, the UK rating for that was 4.8 million. Which is the lowest of the Whittaker era up to that point, crucially lower than Resolution, which had aired on the same date the previous year, on New Year's Day as a public holiday. You know, it's not as big as Christmas, but it's still pretty big. They get decent ratings usually on New Year's Day, and this pulled in far, far fewer. We polled our members of the Type 40 Facebook group on this episode. Of those polled who responded, we have a tally from 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 on level of enjoyment. And 29.6% thought that it was excellent. But more, 35%, went for just plain good. We got 20% of those voting said it was around average, 11% describing it as poor, and 5% choosing the option to exterminate and to wipe it from the canon forevermore. That's a fairly mixed response. I've got a few comments here. Derek Brady, he said, some bits looked really good, but then we get the we're your mates and we're your fam. That seemed to put off Derek quite a bit. Neil Pugh, he despaired of that moment 15 minutes in where Stephen Fry's character says the Doctor is a man, and the Doctor replies, I've had an upgrade. He said he thought that significant other pieces were quite clunky, but credit where credit's due, and it was enjoyable up to a point. James Welsh described it as average, and that he actually enjoyed some of Yaz and Ryan's scenes, but he can't get on board with Jodie as the Doctor. Damien Ashley, hello Damien, genuinely surprised. I thought it was hugely enjoyable. What a great cliffhanger. It all felt so right. And Brandon Lee Mace said that he just watched it. He was relieved and happy that he felt it was the best series opener in a few years. Chibnall entertained me for an hour or so, and so did the cast. I do have questions, but obviously that'll be visited next episode. And finally, Anna Russomano-Broski said that she loved the casting of this episode. The press have been less kind. UK ratings, that's not great. Simon, what you've got the American ratings.
Yeah, and unfortunately, the American ratings aren't great. Episode one got 0.79 million. We have to remember that it's a lot lower in the US than in the UK. The lowest season rate, the lowest rating for season 11 was 0.70.
Well, I don't blame them, Simon, because all Chibnall's done is insult the American audience.
Well, of course, that is true, Sarah. And they've made quite clear that they were insulted by that by the spider episode, Arachnids in the UK.
People have got long memories, haven't they? And it's completely understandable when somebody takes an aim so square. Absence clearly hadn't made the heart grow fonder with the British audience.
He seems to have just made it smaller and, you know, like local politics. I mean, most Americans I know do not care about Brexit. I mean, I don't believe it has a place
in an international world-class series. Yeah. You've got a point. Yeah.
The more the focus on these kind of issues, and you know, you can't. I mean, I know Doctor Who and science fiction can be allegorical, but Chibnall's not doing it like that. He's just falling on the nose.
He's not a good enough writer. Russell T. Davies could do that. Yeah. Stephen Moffat, he chose not to a great deal of the time. He was more fantastical. Mm. But when he chose to, Stephen Moffat could do that. I didn't always agree with his take on things, but I respected what he was trying to do. Mm. It wasn't beyond his talent to do that, and so I never resented it too much.
I'm really concerned by the UK ratings because we've constantly been told since season 11 that it was a roaring success. The BBC have constantly told us that season 11 was a roaring success, and so naysayers like us over season 11 were absolutely wrong because everybody loved it. And we're constantly being told that the ratings were excellent for season 11 because they constantly hung them on that episode one opener. So I feel like I've been sort of berated for the last year or so about how I misjudged season 11 and how it was a brilliant success. And here we are, we're already down. So I'm sorry, where is the success? I don't understand how anybody is going to manage to spin these ratings into being a success.
Well, the very same people who've spent a year berating the likes of you and I about those ratings and sort of waving it in our faces. Look, the first 2 weeks were amazing. We all know why those first 2 weeks were rated so highly. You know, most of us called it before they even aired.
Yes.
Obviously, it's always been a gimmick. Gimmicks are employed for one reason only, to enter into the conversation on this subject. You've got to accept that that is a clear, unarguable truth. But yet these people out there still argue it. These are the same people who are clutching at that for well over a year, now are coming back, certainly to me, with a complete change of tune. Now ratings don't matter at all.
Is that what it is?
It's
okay.
Totally different, which is obviously a conversation for another time. All those same names in all those same places, and bless their hearts, they're obviously loving it a great deal more than I am, or their faith is a little bit more intact.
Nobody wants Doctor Who to fail. No, I don't believe, you know, the three of us, we do not want Doctor Who to fail.
Spot on.
It breaks my heart, but this isn't the way forward.
I totally agree. None of us want Doctor Who to fail. None of us like sitting here being negative. I really, really don't. No. I really want to come in here and say, wow, wasn't that the best episode?
Yeah, I was so depressed on Sunday night. I was sort of, Dan knows because I texted him, and I was really down.
All of us used to wait, counting down months, weeks, days, and sometimes even hours to the opening episode of a new season of Doctor Who in the 70s or the 80s or in the last 10 or 15 years. I think that if any of us don't experience that anymore, you know, people will put it down to the passage of time, to age, to the fact that the show's been back for a long time. And all of those things, you know, they're probably not unfair points to make. When you're on the inside experiencing these things, you know whether that's coming from that place or not. If you're aware of that side to your nature that is perhaps a little bit crusty or a little bit grumpy and who knows, a bit jaded, I think the three of us certainly are reasonably self-aware people, and you're just going to have to take our word for that. If you're listening out there and think we've been talking out of our backsides for the last hour, you're just going to have to take our word for it. Because all we do, this isn't intended as our final word any of the subjects. On any of these episodes we're going to be talking about over the next however many episodes, this is very much a first word on these stories. All being well, we'll be going back to them, re-watching them and revisiting many times over the year. So we'll have opportunities to maybe to maybe.
I'm sorry, you're on your own there, Dan.
You never know. But in an ideal world, subsequent episodes will make us want to go back, rewatch, and reevaluate.
Yes, that's true.
Reevaluate these episodes.
Yes.
You know, maybe we'll feel differently. Who knows? Yeah, we're just going to take a few minutes to tell you about all the other conversations taking place across the whole of pop culture on the Fandom Podcast Network, all those other shows. Here's another of our operatives with a few words on all of that. Then join Sarah, Simon and myself back here to wrap up our TARDIS talk for today.
Thank you for listening. We hope you're enjoying this podcast. We'd like to continue to feed your ears by inviting you to listen to our other awesome shows on the Fandom Podcast Network. It starts with our flagship show, Culture Clash, our weekly pop culture podcast. For you movie fans, we have Couch Potato Theater, where we celebrate our favorite cult classic and guilty pleasure movies. We also have Time Warp. That's our fandom flashback show, where we like to look back on our favorite fandoms. For you NFL fans, we have the End Zone podcast. And of course, for you Alfred Hitchcock fans, please check out Good Evening. For you Star Trek and Orville fans, we also have the Union Federation podcast. And for you hard rock metal fans, we have Hair Metal, the 1980s rock metal podcast. Doctor Who fans, we've got one for you as well. We have Type 40, our Doctor Who podcast. If you're a fan of 1980s action films, please check out Lethal Mullet. And our newest show, we have a Star Wars podcast called What a Piece of Junk. You can enjoy all of these great Fandom Podcast Network shows on our master feed at fpnet.podbean.com. The FPNet can also be found on the Podbean app. The Fandom Podcast Network can also be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. Please search on Facebook for Fandom Podcast Network. You can also email us at fandompodcastnetwork@gmail.com. We are also on Instagram and Twitter under Fandom Podcast Network. Thank you for listening, and remember, respect others and enjoy your fandom.
So many great shows, something for everybody. And there's even merch to match. If you want to visit our Tee Public store and search for the Fandom Podcast Network, you'll find a storefront with all the logos from all the shows on t-shirts, hats, mugs, tapestries. You get the picture. All that geek chic at great prices. And it all goes to support the Fandom Podcast Network into the bargain. So everybody wins. Yeah. So as we were saying, those ratings, they're not as strong as we'd like. We're going to come back to part two on our part two. This is feeling like a crucial year for the series on both sides of the Atlantic, and in the hearts and minds of fans, no doubt on the message boards and social media place and whatever else. So let's hope that we're wowed and charmed by something timeless in every respect at some point later down the line. But just like Bond, Type 40 will return very soon. Look out for that wherever you found this. It could have been on Apple Podcasts. Please search for the Fandom Podcast Network on what used to be iTunes, now Apple Podcasts, where you can drop us a review. Not just for our egos. If you drop us a review, it bumps up us up. Other listeners, new listeners, can find us just that little bit easier. Maybe you've heard us on iHeartRadio. We've just joined iHeartRadio, of course. Or Stitcher, Google Play, Spotify, or the Podbean app. They're good to us on Podbean. It's great. It's very easy to use. It has to be for me to use it. And we're really easy to find. If you search for the Fandom Podcast Network, you'll see our listings there. Anything you want to say to us, you can add reviews of our reviews, if you like. Just come and say hello generally. You can contact any of us directly. Email at Type40DoctorWho. Twitter and Instagram at Type40DoctorWho. Sarah, it's been lovely as always. Thanks for coming and sharing all of that with us. If you're brave enough to return for a follow-up mission very, very soon. What do you say?
Oh, yeah, I'll be definitely back for a return mission.
Because we know you're very much in demand. You could be flying all over the place, tweeting and flying. She's still laughing. We've left you in hysterics this afternoon, haven't we?
You have, yeah. You've really cheered me up.
It's been fun, hasn't it? It's been a pleasure catching up with Simon, as always. You're going undercover, I
guess. Oh, yes, I'm off on a secret mission now out to...
Special missions planned. 2020 is going to be quite a year, but remind people where they can find you across social media, because we never mentioned
Yeah, we did. We said you can come and find me on the Hoonatics page on Facebook, so come and say hello there.
Oh, Danny, had your mind wiped.
Yes, that's the men in black or the women in rainbows. Who knows? One or both. To be continued. Thank you for listening. Join us again next time here on the Fandom Podcast Network for another episode of Type 40, a Doctor Who podcast, where we always have the time if you have the space.